Hello, and welcome to the first of two end-of-year special editions of Big Mouth. It's been a long, strange year, and we've got a medium-length strange show for you, as our special guests take us through their favourite things of the year. Making her Big Mouth debut is journalist Sophie Harris. She's written for Rolling Stone, The Times, Mojo and The Guardian. She's been digital editor at Time Out New York, and she also teaches yoga, so we will bend over backwards to accommodate her. Hello, Sophie, how are you?
Delightful welcome. I'm very well. It's a lot to live up to.
It is a lot to live up to. We were just discussing your yoga expertise and the fact that you really ought to be taking pop stars and famous people to do yoga as a regular feature somewhere.
I know. Why have I never thought of this before?
Well,
it
you
needs
have
to
now.
Happen. I know.
So the Sunday Times takes people to walk their dogs. I think there's a podcast. I think there's a yoga podcast.
A yoga podcast.
Yoga with the Stars.
So what made your new album? It's really good. I think there's probably a possibility.
He's fallen asleep.
We could do special guided meditations with ambient music.
You wouldn't even need the famous person there. You could just say they were there meditating. Today we've got Richie Manick, actually. We found him. Silence. Finger bells.
He's been on a mountain alone for
a long
time.
He's been on a mountain, yeah, and who can blame him? We're going to be doing your favourite things in a minute, but how has 2017 been in general compared to 2016 when everybody died?
Oh, 2016, wow. So 2016, I just moved back from the States where I was for 7 years. And I remember getting back and thinking, I'm so glad I'm back in England now, because so many awful things are happening in America. There was the terrible, like, Black Lives Matter movements and the shootings. And I was thinking, phew, glad I'm back in England. Then Brexit happened. I was thinking, oh God, should I be back in America? Then Trump got elected. So it's back and forth. And so this year has been lovely and peaceful, and also fell in love. So that was...
Oh, that's nice. Okay, well.
Yeah. I'm thumbs up for 2017.
Tremendous. Also with us, we have a returning Big Mouth regular. Mark Hooper is the editor of the handmade artisan crafts magazine Holden Corner. He listens to everything on a hand-carved wooden iPhone using only natural electricity. In a past life, he was a senior editor at Arena and the Face magazines. Now he's more at home in the world of sustainable footwear and hand-polished crockery. Hello, Mark. Welcome back. How are you?
All right. Just been polishing my crockery.
Excellent.
Is that a euphemism?
Come on. Easy. It's Christmas. Don't ruin the moment. The last time you were in on the show, you were telling us about your spoon carving story, the hot world of spoon carving.
Yeah, I've got on a bigger spoon carving event in this amazing kind of Hogwarts-style barn in Wiltshire, which was pretty incredible. Talking of kind of yoga retreats, it was just complete silence all day. These people kind of carving spoons, and then the only injury we had was the band, who the entertainment afterwards, Girl Ray, who the bassist cut a finger, so she couldn't play the bass.
While carving a spoon.
Exactly, yeah.
Spoon carving injury.
And ended
injury.
Up playing the wooden spoon, which is
yes,
quite,
bizarre gardening injury. Yeah. What's been hot in the world of handicrafts this year? What are people looking for in the world
well,
of handmade
it's funny, actually. Everyone sort of go. I mean, we sort of set up the magazine because we kind of had this sense that after kind of, you know, big logos and bling and everything, everyone's getting a bit fed up and going back to kind of a bit of authenticity. So the idea of the magazine was, you know, we're not completely Luddite. We just actually just relaunched our website, holdencorner.com. We just kind of feel that there's, you know, a good way to kind of focus your mind on things which are a little bit more important in the world, particularly with things like Trump happening elsewhere. Just like focus on making things and something you can be proud of, really.
You heard him speaking just then. It's our producer, the man who handcarves this podcast, Matt Hall. Hello, Matt. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. I'm wondering if Mark will be aware of my favourite thing that I've been doing this year, which is... using a Dutch, I think they're Dutch, wool repair kit to not to darn holes in jumpers and stuff, but you basically make a kind of felt by pushing pieces of wool into a hole. Ooh. And it's brilliant. And the holes are all kind of really, the wool repair stuff is all really bright, so you get a grey jumper with kind of loads of pink and orange and kind of so put all dots on. Yeah.
So that's the white hot rock and roll action that you are looking for. Come to expect from Big Mouth, where we live on the edge, rock and roll mouthwash, etc. Okay, so we're going to start with Sophie Harris's favourite things, beginning with her track of the year from the LCD Sound System comeback album, American Dream. This track is Oh Baby. LCD Sound System and Oh Baby from American Dream. Sophie, what did you love about that?
Oh, what's What's not to love? So I was so excited for this album to come out, and I was a big fan of, well, of kind of the second album, I guess. Yeah. And that was 10 years ago, and I remember speaking to him about that and me saying, why do you think it was a big hit? And him saying, because people are old and sad, I suppose. And it always tickled me. And then I wasn't so keen on the record after that. I found it a bit sort of jaunty and nudge. And so when I first put this album on, and this is the first track from that album, you know, didn't know what to expect, a little bit hopeful. And you have these tiny little sounds. You're thinking, what's going to happen? Then you have that huge big bass line comes in. And even just sonically, it's so like grabby in that way, and then the lyrics are so tender, and he sings them in this soft way, in this really like gentle register that we haven't really heard before. And there's a real like honesty and warmth and vulnerability to it.
It's rare when a band comes back, because they sort of think that they should, but also people actually really want them to come back. Yeah. You sort of felt like, because he made such a big song and dance about the farewell, you know, big Madison Square Garden farewell show. This is it. We're splitting up. We're never coming back again. And then he makes a film about it in which he's shown selling his equipment and crying while he sells his stuff. And then subsequently kind of admits that they sort of had to say they were splitting up in order to sell the Madison Square Garden shows. There was a bit of moaning, wasn't there?
There was some moaning, and it surprised me, because I thought, oh, come on, you know what he's like.
Yeah.
You know, he's opened a wine bar and launched his own coffee. He's kind of a businessman, and he's sort of amused by all of it. And so it wasn't hugely surprising to me. And I felt like for the people who'd gone to those last shows, you know, oh, but we spent all this money and did it. It's like, but he probably had a great time, you know.
And yeah, he could get to go to another last show at some point.
Yay!
Mark, did you were you immersing yourself in the LCD Sound System album?
I was, yeah, I loved that. Actually, I was kind of saying, I was looking on my phone, and most of the things I've been listening to this year being about 30 years old, and that was one of the few that I really was really excited about. And it's interesting that he'd obviously been working with Bowie a bit before he died, and there's lots of, you can see, there's almost like some, I think, are probably demos. He was kind of hoping, oh, maybe if I play this, he might put this on his album. Yeah. And then it's, you can see here a few, and there's a few with quite sort of scary monsters, kind of angular guitar and stuff coming in. It's kind of, you know.
What I enjoyed about it was apart from all the things that you've said, the fact that it is really kind of, you know, honest and affecting and, you know, has a kind of sly humour to it, is it's great sort of genre spotting fun. I mean, you know, here's the track that's Power, Corruption and Lies. Here's the tracks that's Scary Monsters. Here's the tracks that's you know, Born Under Punches by Talking Heads. Yeah. He sort of pinches all of those things, but makes them into his own as well.
He does, but he also, I feel like he pinches them just because he wants to. And I think with all of our picks coming up today, what I've loved about them is they feel like they're made by people who just wanted to make that music, you know. Yeah. It doesn't feel mannered or let's make a hit or you know, anything like that. It doesn't feel cynical, I guess.
Mark's just talking about David Bowie there. The closing track, it's black screen, isn't it? And it's got this beautiful conceit of him looking at the black screen of his computer and then wondering where the little black star of David Bowie is, because actually, really, he is in there. He's in the work, he's in the songs, he's in the ideas.
You just gave me a little shiver.
But it's incredibly poignant. I mean, this it is an enormously sad record, and also a very funny record, a very danceable record.
I mean, I think also, though, what's important about this record is that the sadness and the sense of loss is what makes the love and the warmth all the stronger and the realer. And I love that it's a grown-up record. That might be an incredibly dull thing to say, but I like that if you've had a bit of life experience yourself, then you get it.
Has there ever been anybody else who's managed to make not just a career, but also a kind of a winning, likable persona out of, ever since your debut, saying, I'm not as good as I used to be. I've missed everything. I'm rubbish. Young people are better than me. I mean, pretty much his first music was about how crappy he was and how he's missed the boat.
He's done well, hasn't he?
Yeah. But that clearly like connects in something that's in the air. He used to be in an indie rock band and he used to live next door to my missus in New York, and she wishes he'd get his indie rock band Pony back together again. Why is he making this clattery dance music? He should make like bad garage indie like I used to like. And I'm like, well,
I'm sure he is doing that secretly somewhere.
There's a hidden
a basement
album
near you
somewhere.
Maybe if there's a market he identifies for it.
Possibly so.
Not more than just your missus.
More than just my missus, yes. So for your favourite film of the year was Get Out.
Yeah.
The woke horror movie.
And such a necessary movie as well.
But for those who have not seen it, without spoiling it, give us the setup.
Oh,
in a nutshell.
Okay, so
is it Jaws on a boat? No.
No, it's not Jaws.
Jaws is on a boat.
It's kind of. It's there are moments of that. It's like it's a kind of meet the parents scenario, mixed race couple, black boyfriend, white girlfriend, very romantic. Starts out feeling like it just a cute indie movie, and then some strange things happen, and it becomes an incredible kind of, I would say, biting satire, but that makes it sound really po-faced. And it's funny, and it's witty, and it's incredibly exciting, and it's sort of a horror movie, but only insofar as a movie like Don't Look Now is a horror movie. Like, it's a great film that happens to have these kind of shocking, gripping moments. And it's an important movie that came out at exactly the right time.
You got your toothbrush?
Sure.
Do you have your deodorant?
Sure.
Do you have your cozy clothes?
Got that.
What?
Do they know I'm black?
Should they?
You might wanna, you know.
Mom and Dad, my black boyfriend will be coming up this weekend. I just don't want you to be shocked that he's a black man.
I ain't never seen you like this before, bro.
Meeting families and taking road trips. Don't come back all bougie, man.
Come back, get your damn pants up to your damn stomach.
So you guys coming up from the city?
Yeah, we're just heading up for the weekend.
Can I see your license, please?
He wasn't driving.
I didn't ask who was driving. I asked to see his ID.
Call me Dean and you're hungry, my man.
So how long has this been going on, this thing? We hired Georgina and Walter to help care for my parents. When they died, I couldn't bear to let them go.
You smoke in front of my daughter?
I'm gonna quit.
She'd take care of that for you.
How?
Hypnosis.
I'm good, actually.
Are you ready for this?
I'm back in B.
So look, I go do my research. Apparently, a whole bunch of brothers been missing in this suburb.
But it's cool.
Bro, how are you not scared of this, man?
Didn't see no brother around here.
Chris was just telling me how he felt much more comfortable with my being here.
Get out.
Sorry, man.
Get out! Yo!
Rose, we gotta go.
Is everything okay?
Rose, the keys. Just get the keys.
I don't know where they are.
Rose!
Sink into the floor.
Wait.
Sink.
Mom, it's a terrible thing to waste. It's a terrible thing to waste.
People are getting nervous.
So this is a movie where the horror is not located in a kind of gigantic special effect leaping out of the screen, but it's located, it's socially derived.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's it feels very real, which is why it's so shocking. And I think, not to kind of ramble on too much about my own experiences, but having lived in the States for many years, and my ex-boyfriend is African-American, and so obviously as a kind of mixed race couple, you sort of encounter some of these things. And I remember having moved back to England, and as we were discussing that with Black Lives Matter and these kind of young men being summarily executed in cars, having this moment of thinking, oh, all those things that you kind of mentioned that I thought were, you know, maybe not happening so much now, because I was there during the Obama administration. Mm-hmm. Oh, they're real, aren't they? Is it just that we're only hearing about them now? And he was saying, yes, it's exactly that. It's the visibility. It's visibility. It's what's happening now, and that's why it's important that this movie's happening. And so, yeah, it was a wake up call for anyone who didn't notice it. And I feel like this year, 2017, has been a year of kind of exposure. It's like all the nasty things that were under the surface, yeah. E.g. Donald Trump and the support for Donald Trump. It's out in the light now, and what are you going to do about that? And so this movie does precisely that. It says, okay, guys, all this stuff that we thought was fine in the touchy-feely Obama administration, like, this is kind of what's going on with white liberalism and the roots of this country.
I haven't seen it myself, but the clips that I've seen tend to, there's a few standout bits, including white characters repeatedly saying that to the black guy, well, you know, I did vote for Obama. As if that like makes everything like fine and okay and solved.
And the kind of subtle insinuations about black sexuality or like black people got rhythm, like that kind of stuff.
Black people are so cool.
Yeah,
they're so cool.
And, but it's funny, you know. There's a lightness to it. So it's funny and it's profound and it's involving and it's ridiculous at points. It's just a great movie.
Well, what kind of a white person squirm factor would you give it? out of 10?
I'm going to say I squirmed 8 out of 10.
Okay.
How about you?
I haven't seen it. I'm going to... can't see everything.
Give us the squirm report after.
I will, yes.
Did you see the fantastic Instagram that happened, the post that was just before Thanksgiving with a really kind of brolic, pumped up black guy, a picture of himself with his kind of with his guns out, and then an offer that he would... a price list of what he'd do to... as a white American woman, if you wanted to hire him to take him to your racist parents' Thanksgiving, I think the top price was about pulling out a gun and putting it on the table and going, "What are you going to do about it?" But there was lots of other kind of like, slap your bottom as you walked past and ask you to go and get him some food and stuff like that. It was absolute genius.
Magazine feature in the making there. Sophie, tell us about your book of the year. What is your book of the year?
She's brought it in. Reaches into bag is A Revolutionary Ride by Lois Price. This is, I feel like it's a little bit of a cheat because she's my mate and I used to be in an all-girl bluegrass band with her.
That's all right.
This is the book that I loved.
We won't say it's all right until you tell us the name of the all-girl bluegrass band.
I'm very happy to tell you the name of our band because we really thought about it long and hard because we were all music nerds. The name of our band was The Jolenes.
The Jolene.
Because it was kind of cheap and trashy, but steeped in history.
But when you went on tour, then the line could be, we're going to take our love to town. You know.
Well, do you know what happened, though? We were terrible when we started because none of us were very good at our instruments. Then I left for America and they got a singer who was like a proper rhythm guitarist and they got really good. And then they did go on tour and play like prisons in Europe and do the whole Johnny Cash thing. And I was like, I'm really happy for your success.
I think you should now start a really harsh alternative band called Prisons in Europe as your revenge. But anyway, book, Revolutionary Ride.
So, it's a cracker. So it's her third book. She rides motorbikes around the world. And the first one she rode from the tip of the Americas down to Argentina. And she was blogging so much about it, it accidentally turned into a cracking yarn. The second one, she went from the top of Africa down to the southernmost point. And she's riding around Iran. The thing that's so great about her and her writing is she's so warm and funny, and her adventures are kind of born out of a genuine curiosity. And so you have her in these kind of extreme situations, like with the one where she was in Africa. She's riding through a field thinking, you know, it's very peaceful around here. Oh, it's because she's just ridden through a minefield accidentally. but you're learning so much culturally and historically about where she is. But it's written like she's like your mate. So even if she wasn't my mate, I'd enjoy reading it because that's how it feels.
What do we discover about Iran here that surprises us?
That the people are really lovely and incredibly hospitable. And actually, in a funny way, one of the things she notices, the irony of there being this kind of almost like Americanness, American enthusiasm and pluck, and we're going to do it anyway to the culture. So, for instance, because of sanctions, you know, that you couldn't be importing American goods, but they do have Coca-Cola, which is Iranian-made Coca-Cola. And people will say, we'll make it ourselves. We can do that, you know, no problem.
Snide Coke.
I know. And very nice, apparently. And so we're learning, you know, historically about what's going on. And she's a chatter. You know, she talks to people. And so you've got, you know, your drug addicts, teachers, carpet sellers, all sorts. And people, because she's a woman alone on a motorbike, she's such a curiosity that people do want to talk to her.
I was going to ask you, I mean, you know, in one respect, it was the most westernised country before the revolution. It was extremely westernised. But in another respect, you know, as we are very aware, this is an extremely repressive society towards women. How does a woman on a motorbike, a Western woman on a motorbike, you know, how is she taken by this society?
With a whole lot of chutzpah. I think, I mean, just to go back to what you were saying about it being kind of westernized, this sort of, what's kind of interesting about that, though, is that it was a rule that you were no longer allowed to kind of wear the veil. So you also had older women who felt absolutely horrified at leaving the house without a veil on. So there's always been this kind of like orthodoxy to it.
A woman on a motorbike does not fit into the Islamic Republic of Iran, I would imagine. So what is, I mean, does she get into trouble? Is, I mean, at least I suppose her hair is covered with a helmet.
I mean, she wears the veil. She covers herself up properly. But I think she is so charming that it's very disarming for people. And because the site is so unusual, it's not just like a lady wearing high heels and a miniskirt. It's what? Who? Huh? And, you know, and she's received nothing but kindness. Like, men were very kind and respectful of her in the main.
So the kind of, the male travelogue, whether it's kind of Michael Palin or Ewan McGregor and his mate, John Borman's son, you know, getting on motorbikes and kind of doing those kind of travelling around, one way around the world or whatever, is quite a kind of recognised format now. I'm just interested in where the market is for this. What kind of, you know, the grannies looking at nice pictures of Michael Palin having amusing times in the market in Marrakesh is one market. The kind of blokes who wish that they could drop everything and leave their families and children behind and go and drive a motorbike across Antarctica is another market. Where does
but you know what? I don't see why a bloke who wants to leave it all behind and ride to Antarctica wouldn't find it funny, because she's not a girly girl. She's not like, oh, I love those hijabs in the, you know, in the market. What a lovely rug. She is funny, and she's an adventurer, and she has that kind of, I suppose, what we would regard as sort of blokey va-va-voom, right. But which also for women.
But does she also get into
liberating
places that you probably all get people to drop their guard that you wouldn't get with a kind of,
I think,
with a bloke
she does.
On it.
I think she does, because she gets invited into people's homes so much. And so, you know, often there's a kind of like, well, we must look after this young lady. So she gets to see something in a different way.
Does at any point contain the line, "Baby, we were born Tehran"? And if not, why not?
I'm so sad that it doesn't.
Let's move on.
Second edition,
or at least the headline for review. Let's have your favourite album of the year then, which is by Rostam.
Do you know what? I hadn't realised the Iranian crossover, because Rostam Batmandlij is from Vampire Weekend, but he is of Iranian parentage. So his mum wrote, I think, fairly well known in the States, Iranian cookbook.
Oh, right. Yeah. So basically, it's the year that Iran took over all of pop culture, according to you. Tell us about Rostam.
So Rostam was in Vampire Weekend, and all those kind of little sort of flurries of harpsichord, and what I think of as the kind of, I mean, the bits that I loved about Vampire Weekend, those were more his motifs. So you had Ezra was writing the, I mean, I'm sure they all did all of it together, but I feel like Ezra was more the very witty, unusual, you know, urbane lyrics. Yeah. And Rostam was...
Some would say annoying, but anyway, carry on.
Indeed.
Some would say gap year junior.
Some would say jaunty.
Yeah, some would. Yeah, anyway. Yeah.
And Rostam is classically trained, and so he was providing this kind of just lovely, interesting, sometimes quite frilly music. And now he's been and gone and made his own record, having produced a bunch of stuff by some really interesting people. So he's produced with Frank Ocean, Solange, Cass McCombs, Haim, Charlie XCX, bunch of very cool people. And what I love about him is that there's this, it's very hooky and it's very kind of strong on melody, but it's also kind of a producer's record. And he's got this kind of mini Brian Wilson vibe to him. He's now moved to LA and has his studio set up there. And it's also...
Has he got a sand pit? Has he lost his mind and got a sand pit? If he's doing the full Brian Wilson, you have to do that.
Do you know what? I want to go and interview him. I'm going to ask him that. And if he hasn't got a sand pit...
You want
I'm
to know
going to
why.
Suggest it.
Yeah.
I'm going to bring him a little bucket and spade and say, look, we've decided what
Yeah, we're
you
doing
need.
Smile, get on with it.
Cake,
yeah,
lock is, on the fridge.
Brian's doing that song, which is basically, it's got the directions to his house in it. It's amazing.
So the album is a beautiful and fully realised producer's
Yeah, you know, the thing is also, it's not clever. So maybe you would like it more than a Vampire Weekend record.
Well, I found Vampire Weekend, they actually got on my nerves because, I like my intellectual pop, but this was like kind of gap year thesaurus pop, you know, really kind of overdoing it, I thought. And what I like from what I heard from the Rostam record is that it's abandoned, or maybe that's not what he did. You know, it doesn't have that sort of forced raised eyebrow archness, yeah, which can get on your nerves a little bit.
Totally. And I think it's also, I think he's a romantic little soul, you know, and it's a romantic, it's a pretty record. He's also, he composed the music for his brother's movie, The Sound of My Voice, with Britt Marling in, which is an awesome movie. And he also did the music for Kenneth Lonergan's This Is Our Youth, for that play. And so there is something kind of cinematic about it. There's a lot of really unusual samples. And because he's also a producer, it's just beautifully, beautifully done.
Well, let's have a track from it. This is Rostam and Gwan.
All of these dreams keep coming back to me slowly. Slowly. And sometimes I laugh when I think about how well you know me. Yeah, you know me. But all of these dreams keep coming back to me slowly.
Gwan by Rostam, or Gwan, as Matt insists I pronounce it, from our guest Sophie Harris's favourite album of the year, Half Light. Mark Hooper, it's your turn. Is 2017 going to go down as a better year than 2016, do you think?
I'm trying to be ridiculously optimistic this year. I was kind of in despair, and when at the beginning of the year things just seemed to get worse and worse, and now I'm kind of thinking, you know, there's quite a few things like Harvey Weinstein. I'm in total awe of Rosie McGowan, who's basically like turned the tables on patriarchal society, basically, and the fact that now I feel like we can't go back to where we were, and even though Trump's in power and we might all get blown up with a war in North Korea tomorrow, at least it's all out in the open. We know these people have come out of the woodwork.
As we die of radiation poisoning.
And I'm kind of arguing my friends, I'm generally hopeful. I think Mueller's going to totally nail him. I think he's, you know, he's amazing, legally trained mind who plays the slow game. And I think there's no way that Trump isn't going to perjure himself because he just lies all day. So
the thing is, did you hear the story that we're recording this kind of in the middle of December? Did you hear the story about John Oliver and Dustin Hoffman?
Yes,
which is kind of really interesting. And it's that so they were doing a 20th anniversary of Wag the Dog.
Yeah, that's right.
Screening at the Tribeca Film Festival, and Oliver was doing the panel beforehand, and Hoffman came on. Expecting, you know, with I think another couple of actors expecting to do the blah blah blah, and Oliver basically took it to him over kind of the allegations that an intern had made that he was he'd kind of assaulted her on the stage,
and
it wasn't just a kind of let's get this out of the way, it was a kind of bang bang bang. And you kind of think that's a really interesting thing that happened, and then you look at what happened with when Mel Gibson came on a BBC chat show recently, Graham Norton's chat show, and that it wasn't mentioned.
Yeah,
the whole background, his history, and you kind of think maybe things are changing, that people aren't powerful enough or big enough that all of a sudden you can get that.
Let's get into Mark's choices. We're going to start with your film of the year. This is the movie Dunkirk. Put that light out. It's a bit of the trailer.
The enemy tanks have stopped.
Why?
Why waste precious tanks when they can pick us off from the air like fish in a barrel?
There are 400,000 men on this beach.
Where are we going?
Dunkirk.
There's no hiding from this, son. We have a job to do.
If we go there, we'll die.
Christopher Nolan's Dunkirk, Mark Hooper's film of the year. Why is it so great then, Mark?
Well, it's a bit of a weird one, because I don't think it's the best film I've seen this year, which probably is a... already disqualified. But it was the most surprising for me, because It wasn't at all what I expected. I didn't really... Weirdly, there wasn't really any hype about it. I saw a trailer which was literally... It was shorter than the one you just played. It was like, you know, 10 seconds long, and it was just a crowd of people on a beach looking up, and there's a sound of a Stuka bomber coming down. I thought, well, that's quite impressive. And it was just one thing. I just went with my wife. We, you know, we kind of had a spare evening, so we thought we'd go and see what was on at the cinema. And being a Christopher Nolan film, it was so quiet, and even... It almost throw back to those sort of old war films you'd see where it felt like there were like 20 extras who'd move around the beach. There was a few kind of sweeping landscape shots, but generally it focused on very small stories and understated, which is not what I'd expect from Christopher Nolan. And the fact that Harry Styles is in it loads, and you don't spend the whole film thinking, oh my God, that's Harry Styles. And he actually, in many ways, I think he underacts Mark Rylance, who's one of my favourite actors, because he doesn't do much acting. He obviously acts brilliantly by not... He basically steals the scene by being silent. It reminds me of sort of Alec Guinness in Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy, where, you know, everyone else looks like a complete ham because they're overacting.
Are you saying that Harry Styles is the new Alec Guinness?
Well, yeah, he could be. And the best thing is, I sort of
we had
show,
poor quotes.
And they said, what are you going to do next? And he said, I think I should leave it there, which is even better, because he thought, I've done a good one, I'm not going to blow it now. And the other thing which really, I think, was most impressive about it, I didn't really realise until I was sort of geeking out on the internet with some friends at work, but the soundtrack by Hans Zimmer, there's a thing called the Shepherd Tone, which is basically this cyclical crescendo. So it builds up the tension. It feels like it's this crescendo which never reaches a peak, and actually it's going in a circle, so it kind of it's sort of diminishing and crescendo, but there's this sense of building tension. It's a very common trick in sort of, you know,
it's just Hans Zimmer's new thing to replace the blank that he was putting on everything.
There are a few of those too, to be fair. But yeah, it was just, in a way, it was just a nice surprise, and it was quite, and there's obviously, I still don't really understand, presumably it came out this year because of Brexit and there's some metaphor there, but I can't work out what the metaphor is.
I don't know about that, because, I mean, it takes such a long time to get a film off the ground, doesn't it? And the idea that, like, the Brexit vote goes through quick making Dunkirk film. Bloody Farage did say all young people should go and see this film and stood portentously in front of a poster. Yeah. I think it's a great idea. Yeah, because, you know, a disorderly retreat from Europe led by people who don't know what they're doing in total panic is a really good metaphor for Brexit, actually. Thank you very much.
And actually, the French, there was some criticism that there's a bit which sort of historically inaccurate where they tell a group of French soldiers they can't get on the next boat because the next one's for the England. Apparently, that's rubbish. It was first come, first served. And everyone was very patiently queuing up like the British do and the French, apparently. The French come out of it, like one of the main heroes in it, you don't actually realise to begin with is French, and his best mate is protecting him all the way through. And also the very start of the film is these French soldiers sacrificing themselves so that English can get away. So it's not at all anti-French either, you know, if anything it's the opposite. So,
well, there's been a little bit of a glut of patriotic movies lately. We had a quite a poor Churchill movie. It was Brian Cox showing Churchill being sidelined over D-Day. We've got Gary Oldman coming up in what looks like a fairly superior one. But I am of the age where you grew up with the Second World War as part of, you know, your weekly war comics and everything else. This is my cultural world, and I'm getting sick of it because I am tired of Britain being locked in this. Everything, the Second World War is the metaphor for everything. Everything we do in the world is us showing the world and standing alone and us standing against Europe. I'm now sick of it. I don't want to see any more of it.
Yeah.
Sophie, what do you think? You've been away from the UK, you know.
I have, and I feel like there's two things going on with the war obsession. One, it's the god-awful Brexity empire, you know, hang up. But I think the other thing on a kind of global level is that, like, everything is about belonging and identity now. Everyone's national crisis has to do with, you know, well, we're American, well, we're English, well, we're, you know, whatever, and, like, reclaim our identity. Like, what is it? And so it's born of that anxiety.
I think one of the things with being English is that you sort of imagine yourself to be default. You imagine English being... vanilla.
We do.
And if everybody else is different.
When you look at your standard world map, you know, which I think was designed and laid out in the Victorian era, possibly, it's like, and guess who's at the middle of the world map? Yes, It's England.
But Sophie, that's where Greenwich Mean Time is. What do you expect?
What do you expect?
It's got to be the sense of, well, I do love the fact that everywhere in the world observes Greenwich Mean Time, apart from France has its own meridian going through Paris.
Awesome.
Very, very French.
There's a brilliant book, which I read, talking of this kind of identitarianism. There's a brilliant book which came out a few years ago called The Man Who Saved Britain, and it's about James Bond. And it's about James Bond and Ian Fleming's... Fortunate that James Bond came along at the right time when the British Empire was being divested, when the war the cost of the war was kept everyone in debt, and that when it was proven that actually our Secret Service was complete shambles because of the kind of the whole kind of Cambridge spy ring, and it's a really interesting kind of take on it. The other thing I'd just very quickly like to say is that if you are raging against Farage, is a brilliant new Twitter feed called Toothless Farage, where basically somebody's taken pictures of Farage and airbrushed out his top teeth, so he looks like he's an old toothless fella.
I think,
which is
increasingly the surprise to me is when you take Nigel Farage's teeth out, he looks like Marky Smith, which is genuinely disturbing. Mark Hooper, your book of the year, David Bowie: A Life by Dylan Jones.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is I've known Dylan Farage. I work with him. He's also editor of GQ now. He's written countless books, some better than others. Some about David Cameron, who I wasn't particularly interested in. He wrote a book on iPod, which is a huge seller, but then obviously, you know, is very time specific, and it's not the sort of thing you see in secondhand shops now because everyone knows what an iPod is. But this, it just feels like it's so brilliantly done. It's for me, it's a definitive book on Bowie. It's just. Basically a series of, like, it's an oral history of David Bowie, so everyone he'd worked with pretty much. There's a couple of big exceptions, like Tony DeVries's first manager, who he interviewed at length and then said he wanted a fee of £300,000 for it to come out. And Dylan apparently said, you've obviously got a very inflated opinion of the value of printed page these days.
But also, once you've done an interview...
Yeah.
You can't then.
Yeah, he wouldn't. And I think actually the weird thing...
What would happen if you put that interview in the book? Because you've done an interview, it's done. You can't then turn around and go, actually, I don't want you to use it.
And he was quite... There was a few kind of, you know, ex-lovers and stuff who, in retrospect, said they didn't feel comfortable with themselves being quoted in the book. And Dylan took that out. There's a few he kind of refers to, but he doesn't actually give the whole quote and stuff. But it's, you know, it's kind of like the Book of Revelations for a Bowie fan. And I kind of had a kind of weird situation where the year before Bowie died, I went, my wife's from Australia, I went on sort of extended holiday there, and then my brother got married in LA, so I was out of the country for over a month. And the day I went to fly out, I tried to update my iTunes, talking of iPods, and something went wrong, and it deleted everything apart from Scary Monsters, which was the last one I'd loaded on there. So I had this, probably about 6 weeks, non-stop of just listening to Scary Monsters, and a lot of flying and lots of travelling and driving around in Australia and in LA, well, California. And so I kind of listened to it more than I'd ever listened to an album in my life, I think. And then because I got so obsessed with it, I started listening to it on the train all the time. I didn't bother updating my iTunes. So I think for probably about 4 months, I listened to it twice a day at least.
That's like a proper Walkman, you know, when we had
exactly,
tapes.
Yeah,
and that was
you
it, you were stuck with it.
Yeah. Yeah, or if your Walkman got slightly busted and it wouldn't open up, so you just had to listen to that one tape. Yeah.
I'd be interested to know how it might read for a non-massive superfan.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I think there's really good, there's lots of little insights. And I mean, there's a great bit that Dylan mentions himself where he says he goes to a playback and there's this, for a music journalist, it really sort of gave me the cold chills because he said there's nothing worse than a playback when the artist is in the room. And it was just, I think, him, possibly a couple of other journalists and Bowie. And it was listening to one of his later albums, I can't remember which one, but not a particularly good one. And he started off enthusiastically. And as it went on, he was kind of giving a little bit of, I can see what you're trying to do there. And he said he got this look from Bowie where he was being very polite and just sort of looked at him and said, basically, he realised, like, my job here isn't to give any sort of criticism or advice, it's to say how wonderful you are.
To encourage David Bowie so he doesn't get down in the dumps. Yeah.
And, you know, there's lots of little touch, like lots of human bits. And the thing which comes out most is that, I find him fascinating as a person, and this idea that he had this real kind of generosity, but it was all done by his rules, so... He would kind of have, it's almost like sort of a deal with the devil where he'd say, you know, I'll give you 5 years of hanging out with me. We'll go on world tours. You'll have amazing fame. And then I'll never speak to you again. And everybody, no one felt bitter about that. Loads of people got cut off by him because he'd moved on to something else. And he was very good at sort of finding what was interesting at the time. And there's this kind of amazing sense that everyone he spoke to, no one had a bad word to say about him, even though he'd treated some people pretty shoddily, really. But yeah. I said, oh, that's fine. That's the trade-off, you know. I get to hang out with David Bowie and become famous and have a hit record, and that's where it goes.
Is there a tenderness in his tone? Because what I've found sometimes when I've read rock biogs, even if I'm not massively obsessed with the artist, if the writer, if they're, you know... It's like the tenderness in that Elvis biog, you know, in every single detail. It's like he loves Elvis.
Yeah, I think there is. I mean, he's obviously probably obsessed, but Dylan's obviously probably obsessed with Bowie. But also the fact that it's an oral history is it's the people who are closest to him, so they've all got a tenderness to him. Someone like Jeff McCormack, who weirdly turned out to be a friend of a friend of mine. I weirdly spent a night on a stag do with him, sharing a room with him, and didn't realise who he was at the time. And then I suddenly realised he wasn't. I got his email. We featured him. Unlikely subject for Hole and Corner, but we got him to give us some anecdotes for our magazine recently. And he, because he was a school friend of David Bowie's, and he went on tour with him in some of his biggest albums in the 70s, and he turned out to be a really good photographer, so he took all his photography as well. And, you know, he's his best mate. And unlike what I just said, he stayed best friends forever, and even though they were living apart. And there's lots of lovely little touching things where when he died... Well, before he died, Bowie got in touch. Nobody knew he was ill, and he said, "You should send me some of your prints, and I'll sign them for you because they'll be more valuable." And that was his way.
Oh, wow!
And this is what he wrote for us for Hole and Corner magazine, because he basically said that's a very Bowie way of doing things, because he's saying, "I'm not going to leave you some money. I'm going to give you the means to make some money out of your own talent."
Mm. Yeah.
And the most touching thing was at the end of that. There's one photo of him asleep on the Trans-Siberian train in one of those sleeper cabins, and he'd signed it, "Night, Night, Jeff." And when he came to sell it, he didn't realise he was dying. And then he suddenly was like, "That's him saying goodbye to me."
Wow. Your TV show of the year?
Yeah, Ronnie Cheng, International Student, which is one of those shows. I've kind of got this weird TV habit. I haven't got Netflix. I kind of watch box sets a little bit. But I've realised quite often I'm talking about TV shows with people. And I think I've seen them. And then I realised I've just seen it on Gogglebox. Somebody mentioned some major part of the plot. I was like, "I don't remember that." And I was really kind of racking my brains for something. This is something I think I was probably watching, you know, something, Match of the Day or something. It was like late on TV, and I changed the channel and this came on. And I've just watched all the episodes now on YouTube. So Ronnie Cheng is the guy's name. He's a comedian. He's sort of Malaysian born, and he's one of the senior correspondents on The Daily Show on Comedy Central. And it's this show. It's kind of like a weird mixture of kind of Fresh Meat stroke The In-Betweeners meet Summer Heights High. So it's an Aussie production, and it's set in Melbourne University, and Ronnie Cheng is an international student, hence the name. And it's this brilliant sort of play where he's the underdog, and the kind of the new underdog in a way is the Asian stroke Oriental student in a college. He's the one everyone ignores and stuff. Yeah. And it's brilliant. It's really subtle. He's hilarious, and it kind of you see everything through his eyes in this sort of brilliant, sort of sardonic way. And there's a big joke about Asian people can't hold their drink, and he's a bit of a geek, so he talks about, you know, "I don't have the enzyme to process alcohol," and the whole, obviously, he's in a university in Australia, so there's a massive drinking culture, and everyone's continuous, all these jocks trying to get them to drink alcohol. So that's kind of an ongoing theme, and it has this brilliant kind of playful moments where a bit like Flight of the Conchords, it goes into sort of dream sequences, so there's a fight and it turns into Power Rangers and stuff. But it's just this brilliant, it's like a really great take where it's he's just such a sort of warm character, and he's like,
I think this is the thing that makes the comedy that stands out now has it at its heart some kind of good-naturedness or warmth to it. Yeah. Even something really painful like Fleabag, there's like a human warmth to it. I mean, the sort of the kind of days of the kind of Frankie Boyle, everything is shit, we hate everybody comedy. People don't seem to love that at all. Yeah, you know, exactly, it's just painful and miserable, isn't it? Yeah. Was this on BBC Four? Did you say?
Yeah, BBC Four. Yeah.
Okay, and is it still available on the iPlayer? Do you know? Or?
It is. Yeah.
Ronnie Cheng, international student. Okay, right. And finally, your album of the year, I think, was Charlotte Gainsbourg's Rest. Is that right?
Yeah.
Tell us why.
It sounds, on paper, it sounds quite depressing. So it's called, it's
again,
called Rest.
Put that on the sticker. On paper, sounds quite depressing.
So it's called Rest, as in rest in peace, because it's dedicated to her half-sister, Kate Barry, who was a photographer who died. And it's also, I didn't actually realise this, but reading up about it, it's a play on words, as in rest in French with an E means stay. So it's kind of saying, you know, the title track, there's a bit of play on words. So she's saying, rest in peace, but she's saying, kind of stay, I don't want you to go. And she's obviously got, you know, amazing pedigree, Charlotte Gainsbourg, and pretty good genes. So, you know, her bits of the album sound like, you know, some of the melodies. There's a song called Kate, actually, which is straight out of Serge Gainsbourg's songbook. And quite fortunate she sounds exactly like Jane Birkin. She's got that bilingual thing, so she can sing in perfect French, obviously, because she's French, but she also speaks sort of Queen's English as well. Very, very kind of amazing kind of variation, even though it's one person singing. But the really surprising thing is all this is done with a kind of, it's basically like a tour of the best of French music. So a lot of it's very French disco. Guy Manuel de Homem Christo, I think I said that right. Mm-hmm. Daft Punk is one of the producers and songwriters. And this guy Sebastian, who I thought it was Sebastian Tellier actually, but it's not. It's a guy who he's produced with Frank Ocean. And so there's a kind of disco beat behind everything, and it's kind of, there's an amazing song. It's called Sylvia Says, which is quote Sylvia Plath for the lyrics, but it's kind of like a early 90s French disco hit as well. It's such a brilliant mixture. And then bizarrely, Paul McCartney pops up writing and performing on one of the songs called Songbird in the Cage.
Okay, let's have a track. This is from Charlotte Gainsbourg's Rest. This is Deadly Valentine. Charlotte Gainsbourg with Deadly Valentine from the album Rest. And there's no point in having your own podcast if you can't show off what you like yourself. It's Matt's turn next week, so hold tight for rare gangstar B-sides and cop movies. Well, this is my best of 2017, starting with my film of the year. It didn't do the box office it was expected to, and it was a subject of a lot of rather poorly written hot takes, I think, about its portrayal of women, which we will get to in a minute, after an excerpt from Blade Runner 2049.
Your job once. I was good at it.
I know.
What do you want?
I want to ask you some questions. The key to the future is finally unearthed. Bring it to me. They know you're here.
I always told you, you're special.
Let me tell you about my mother. A bit of my movie of the year there, Blade Runner 2049. Okay, I'm a massive cliche, but it is an incredible achievement, a sequel that matches and expands upon the original, and unlike most blockbusters, this is a movie with an intellectual question at its heart. What is human and who deserves to be human? It's not an easy question to answer. The film is about slavery and dehumanization, especially of women, and few of the key characters are actually human. It raises the question of, well, who's being treated how here? You know, there are female characters, but they're not actually female. They're female identified, and they're male characters. And not actually male. Hands up who saw Blade Runner 2049. Matt didn't, but everybody else did.
I like a hands up on radio.
Hands up on radio, yes. Like ventriloquism on Radio 4 on ITMA. Sophie, what did you make of it?
Well, you know, I've got kind of mixed feelings because as a big fan of the original Blade Runner, there's definitely something about this film. It's like a lovely bath for Blade Runner fans. It's like, give me this and that and all of these things from the original.
A lovely bath of murder and horror and death, yes.
Just sort of poetically immerse me in this environment. So I really enjoyed it in that way. I think there were some problematic aspects to it. And as our mutual friend Joel Morris of Ladybird Books fame we were talking about it, and he was saying that he feels like, you know, part of the what was so striking about the original is it was predicting a future that hadn't yet happened. Yeah. And it was horrifying because we thought, oh, my God, but what if really? Whoa. You know, and this new Blade Runner inhabits that world, and those things did happen, and we know they happen. So things like artificial intelligence, you know, virtual sex, that kind of thing,
they're,
you know,
all happening.
It's like, so there you go. So it's not interesting in that way.
I think it's interesting in another way, and sort of more disturbing in another way, because effectively, in original Blade Runner, the ecological collapse and the wider economic collapse of society is a background
That's true.
To a film noir. In this, this is what the film is about. This is, you know, it is foregrounded. Economic and ecological collapse mm-hmm. have happened. They've conditioned everything. And to me, the complaints that the fact that the film portrayed women badly or was, you know, exploitative misses the point of the film. This is a world in which people have become products and products have become people.
Yeah.
Everybody is reduced to their USP. Mm. Well, and if you're a woman, your USP is you're a sex object.
But
that's to portray it is not to endorse it. And I thought that was what got on my nerves about the attack on the film.
I see what you're saying. Question. What I felt was that the women were a bit, she's a bad woman, she is a good woman. Whereas with the men, they got to be a little bit more complex. Like Gosling, you know, kind of a good man, I guess, kills people, I guess. Harrison Ford, bit, you know, it's...
I don't think the male characters are that complex. I mean, it's film noir.
Did you not?
So yeah, it's film noir, so everybody is a very simple character. I mean, in the classic film noir, it's just a detective getting through his day. But it just happens that this particular day is a momentous day that they were not expecting. And for me, the female characters, the character Love, the replicant assassin, she's built and designed to be a killer. That is her character. There was complaints that, you know, so many of the replicant women are prostitutes. Well, if women are produced by an industrial society, they're probably going to be sex workers, actually. Yeah. And if this film had been a kind of stereotypical strong female character had been introduced into this movie, it would have betrayed the premise of the movie. Yeah. This is a dystopia because it turns people into products. And that's what the film's about.
There's one really misogynistic scene which I kind of really ruined it for me, because this would have been my film of the year, I think, and visually it's amazing.
Which scene?
This sort of birth scene, sort of. I don't want to go into too much, but it's just I thought, what's that? Yeah. I don't know what that's there for, and it seemed a bit. It was just about control, and I think it was just to
show us how horrible Jared Leto is, and he's the weakest thing in the film.
Yeah. He is.
He's
isn't
the
he?
Worst thing about. Yeah.
Well, I was going to say, I think the strongest character is I've forgotten the actress, but the Ryan Gosling's boss.
Yeah.
She's amazing. She's really subtle, and she's a goodie and a baddie at the same time, and strong and weak. And
do you
I thought
think
that
she was a goodie at the same time?
Yeah, I think so. She's kind of, well, to begin with, there's a definite warmth to it.
Oh, and his boss, not
yeah,
the
yeah, no, not the baddie, baddie. Yeah. Yeah, I thought that was and much more subtle than, you know, Harrison Ford or...
That's true.
Yeah, I mean, Harrison Ford is a great kind of... the word iconic is overused, but he actually appears here as an iconic figure. Mm. He is not just the figure from the original film, but he is the representative of what that job used to be when it was done by men with battered principles, and now it's done by machines, programmed machines who are trying not to be machines, and that to me is the pathos in the film.
Do you know why Vangelis didn't do the music for this one?
I don't.
Because I was so happy when we had that little refrain at the end, the original Vangelis refrain, because it was Hans Zimmer, wasn't it, who did the music for this one, and I felt like it was just a bit derivative, and then I was like, oh, Vangelis at the end.
Yeah. I really, for all the objections and the fact, I don't care that it didn't do big box office. I thought it was a fantastic
I loved it.
Film. I didn't care that it was massively long. It's like, this is what I want my intelligent, grown-up blockbusters to be like. Mm-hmm. And the fact that it can produce the debates that it did, I think, is worthwhile. I mean, just, I really do think that people need to get over the idea that betrayal is endorsement, you know. So anyway, fantastic. My TV show of the year, again, I am a massive nerd, but we weren't able to talk about it when it came out at the time. It's Legion on the Fox Channel, which is the best Marvel adaptation, even better than Jessica Jones or Daredevil. It is superpowers as mental illness, or is it mental illness as superpowers? The character David, who is loosely related to the X-Men universe, he does not know if he's mad or almost godlike in power, or even if he is real. He's in an asylum. And it's entirely possible that he's just a crazy guy off the street, and it's entirely possible that he's the most powerful mutant in creation. We see a wheelchair at the top of the stairs. We don't really know why. Hem, hem, it's Professor X. And I just the thing that I loved about it is this, you know, this is not a show that got a great deal of attention. It went out on Fox, who watches Fox. It wasn't part of the Netflix umbrella of, you know, great media attention. Netflix superhero movies have been rather disappointing this year, to my mind. What is great about this is it just looks so amazing. It has the visual feel of The Prisoner or a very hyper-stylized 1960s spy movie. Dan Stevens from Downton Abbey is in it. He's playing David, the key character. Aubrey Plaza is in it. She's fantastic. She turns into Bob Dylan at one point. And the female lead, played by Rachel Keller, is called Syd Barrett. So you kind of know where you're going here.
You're selling it to me now.
And it's got Jermaine from Flight of the Conchords in it, existing on the astral plane. If you can imagine Sapphire and Steel with a present-day budget for just the great surrealism and what the hell is going on here. If you can imagine, I mean, it's based on a set of Marvel comics drawn by Bill Sienkiewicz, who's the most abstract comics illustrator in mainstream comics, a guy that used woodcuts and gouache and photocopies.
Series on toasters with Alan Moore. That he did ran to three episodes.
Yeah,
surprisingly.
Yeah.
And incredibly, Legion manages to convey the visual texture of Bill Sienkiewicz's mad world onto TV, and I recommend it absolutely highly. So if you can find it, Sophie's eyes are popping out. Do you like superhero stuff?
Well, what I was going to say is, do you have to be a committed, literally, comic nerd
no.
to appreciate it? But then what you've told me, and, Jermaine on the astral plane, and yeah. Dylan and gouache.
It's a Marvel series, but it's almost not a superhero thing at all. It is about the distorting power of imagination run riot to the extent that this guy's mind is so powerful it's reshaping the world around him. And you're never quite sure what you're watching. It's great on playing on, untrustworthy narration and untrustworthy perspectives. I just thought it's absolutely fantastic. It's something you can watch three times. So Legion, available on DVD right now. Another recommendation is, again, a comic book. Surprise, surprise. It's DC Comics' update of The Flintstones, which is really funny and really generous and really clever. The original Flintstones cartoon series satirized the 1950s. So it's like a Joe Paycheck thing, riding his dinosaur to work and working in the quarry. This does exactly the same for the 21st century. So you get consumerism, you get social media, you get people who've come back, you've got survivors of the Paleolithic Wars having to go to their support group and talk about their feelings. It's got this fantastic, clever take on the modern world placed in the prehistoric times. Loads of fantastic visual gags. Bam Bam is going to go and see Nick Caveman. There's a bar called Plato's Cave. It's brilliantly written by Mark Russell and brilliantly drawn by Steve Pugh. So everybody, start reading comics and read The Flintstones. And finally, my choice for the best album of 2017. It was a close-run thing. It was nearly the LCD Sound System record, but mine is Mass Seduction by St. Vincent. This record is just fantastic. Big, giant electronics and clanging metal, plus melodies and a really imperious personality. I presume we've all heard Mass Seduction by St. Vincent. Sophie, you're nodding enthusiastically. Do you like this record?
Do you know, I kind of admire it more than I love it. I think it's a great record. I've always found her a tad frosty. But on this record, she's also funny and arch and sexy. And it reminded me weirdly in tone of Madonna's Material Girl. There's that kind of robotic, kind of glossy coldness to it that I really dug. And it kind of turns confessional singer-songwriting on its head because it's not that, poor me, my diary. Yeah. But it is very kind of intimate as well.
I like the fact that you just feel like, for an hour, you feel like you're inside the head of somebody who's fully aware that they're outside of mainstream functioning society and is completely at home with it. It's totally imperious, totally kind of full of confidence. And as you say, very, very funny and extremely sexy. But the things that also stood out, the melodies and the songwriting are fantastic. She's an incredible abstract guitarist. We talk about Robert Fripp on Scary Monsters. She's in there with Robert Fripp in the same category.
Yeah, well, and I think what's happening at the moment, and I may be overly optimistic here, but we're finding that pop music is becoming interesting again. Like, if you watch Top of the Pops from the early 80s, you're like, oh my God, this was in the top 10? Really? Yeah. It's so weird. And then you have a record like the St. Vincent record. It's so, imaginative, but really crisp and immediate. It's a proper pop record.
What I found really tiresome about what's going on under the banner of so-called alternative music for going on 10 years now is that it's maudlin and it's introspective and it's po-faced and it's fundamentally narcissistic and self-pitying, and this is not. This is a big outward-looking record that's saying, here is my madness and I'm happy within it. Oh, and by the way, here's a fantastic tune like Pills, 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 or here's a fantastic Portrait of Contemporary Los Angeles.
Yeah, and I hadn't realised really how funny she is, and I was reading an interview recently where it was talking about her dressing up as a toilet at a charity benefit, and she recently also described Trump as a cartoon yeast infection.
Oh, there you go. Well, on that bombshell, we're going to finish with something from this. The album I could not stop playing since it came out. This track is a bit Christmassy and a bit urban country heroiny, and I might need to dry my eyes a little bit at the end. From Mass Seduction by St. Vincent, this is Happy Birthday, Johnny.
Last time you called, it was on New Year's Eve. You asked me for dough to get something to eat. Since we last spoke, you live on the street. Yeah, I wouldn't believe all the shit that you've seen. Happy New Year, Johnny.
Is it 23? No, it's just a bit of dust in my eyes. Happy birthday, Johnny, by St. Vincent's. We'll be back next week with more of the best of 2017. In the meantime, thank you to our guest, Sophie Harris. Please come back on a normal Big Mouth when you can talk about just what happens to appear in the calls of the week. And to Mark Cooper, please come back and hand Carver's a microphone from, you know, Birchwood or something like that. Remember, you can hear this episode and all of our back catalogue again on audioboom.com/channel/bigmouth. You can subscribe via Apple Podcasts should you wish, and if you could leave us a review and a star rating, that would really make our Christmas. Thanks for listening. We'll see you again next week. Bye.